This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hey, we're back, and we're 1 week closer to Penn State football. Mike the Mailman had a pretty good week this last weekend on the Trends to Treasure.
That's good.
A little 4-2 action. It should have been 5-1, Mailman. Boy, I was really disappointed. Dan Mullen taking the foot off the gas in the fourth quarter there. I thought that 17.5 was an easy cover. And then all of a sudden, he pulled a Jopa.
That's okay.
You know, they turtled up, and in came the backups on defense. And, man, that was a garbage cover in that game.
That's all right.
So we're going to talk a little bit of everything on today's show. We're going to talk a little ice cream. We're going to talk a little football. And we're going to talk a little Bill O'Brien. Grab your pencil and your paper. It's the obligatory PSU podcast.
I've wondered how President Nixon could know so little about Watergate in 1973 and know so much about college football in 1969.
This is the obligatory PSU podcast, presented by HappyValley.com. You've listened to all those other Penn State podcasts. Now, listen to another one.
All right, we're back. Chris Buchanani here with, as I mentioned earlier on the other side, Mike the Mailman.
Hello, everybody.
Former Penn State and NFL defensive tackle Brandon Noble.
Hi.
OnwardState.com, something, something, Kevin Horn.
Eating noodles.
Good stuff. And later in the show, we're going to have our friend Chad Washington rejoin us again on the podcast from the Fort Bend Herald to talk a little bit about the news, late-breaking news, that Bill O'Brien has been shown the door. So his first stint as an NFL head coach has officially come to an end. But before we get there, guys, I want to remind all our listeners that the second week of the Penn State Berkey Creamery's Fantasy Flavor League is kicking off, as you are listening to this, probably going Tuesday, October the 6th through Friday, October the 9th. You can log on to creamery.psu.edu and vote in the Cookie Bowl. Two classic ice cream flavors done right by the Creamery, chocolate chip cookie dough versus cookies and cream. And it was a close one last week, guys. But as we predicted, Alumni Swirl was victorious over Scholar's Chip.
Yeah.
Which is the way I've been told I'm supposed to say it.
This week a tough call. Boy, both of them are so good. They're so good.
Last week, apparently, I was saying Scholar's Chip, and it was irritating Kevin. So I'm supposed to say it more like the word, Scholar's Chip. Anyway, they lost. So I agree, Mike. This is a tough one this week. We did a little segment about this for video segment for social, but I'm going to let you guys go a little bit more in depth. And since you brought it up, Mailman, let's start with you. Cookies and cream versus chocolate chip cookie dough. Creamery version of both of these flavors, like the elite GOAT iteration of these two classic flavors. Who you got?
I like them both. I'm sorry. I really do. They're both really good.
Yes,
but Mike, chocolate chip cookie dough probably win for me.
Okay, very good. I mean, yes, Creamery ice cream is good. We get that you like them both. Cookies and cream. Why are you giving them the nod over the cookie dough?
It just sounds better.
All right, an honest man. I appreciate
that's science
it.
Right there, boys.
Yeah,
a lot of study.
Yeah. And you trust this man with your gambling bets.
Kev, what about you? You had some good thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, so there are obviously two flavors that any ice cream maker worth their salt makes, but the cream, it's like the best version of those two flavors that you've ever had. And the cream, I mean, cookies and cream, it is, I mean, these are both top 10 ice cream flavors at the Creamery, potentially top 7, potentially top 5, if we want to go that far. It is certainly the best cookies and cream you'll ever have. I would be voting for that. The cookie dough is good. It's unique in that, so a lot of ice cream makers, their cookie dough will just be vanilla with cookie dough chunks. It'll just be like their base vanilla with cookie dough chunks. The Creamery infuses the cookie dough flavor into the actual vanilla base, which is fairly unique.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is just cookie dough. The only complaint you could ever have about that flavor is that the chunks are not big enough or pervasive enough or consistent enough throughout the ice cream itself. But it doesn't quite matter as much when they actually infuse the flavor into the vanilla itself. So the only reason I would vote for cookies and cream is because it's absolutely flawless. Like, there's nothing I could even say that you could improve it versus cookie dough. You know, there it is elite, but there's certainly the one thing that you can at least feign complaint about. I do think cookie dough will win because people are basic and they're just like, oh yeah, I remember grandma's house having cookie dough. And then that's the end of the equation.
Right.
So
that's an interesting take.
I do think cookie dough coming out on top, but cookies and cream is what I would be voting for. But you really, I mean, these are elite teams.
If this were like a matchup of two college football programs, who would they be? Like, what would this? This would be like this would be like Notre Dame, Alabama before Alabama got really good again. Like back in the early 2000s, right? Like when they were both like pretty good.
Yeah, but traditional powers.
Yeah, exactly. Mailman, who, let me just go back to you for a second before I let Noble chime in on this. You said you would take cookies and cream for whatever lame reason you gave. Which one do you think is going to win? Handicap it for us, Mailman.
I would think cookies and cream will win.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to give my thoughts on that in a minute. But Brandon, I know you... You went a different direction when we talked about this in terms of the flavor.
Yeah, this one's we just rescued a dog, and so it sounds like there's absolutely World War III going on in my house right now. And that's because Joey has been let out of his crate and is absolutely going bat crazy right now. For me, it's chocolate chip cookie dough.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree 100% with Kevin about all of the critiques of cookie dough. But what I found is now that I know all of those things about it, I know that the dough is not evenly dispersed and there's not a lot of it. So I've learned how to eat it in a way to maximize the actual chunks of cookie dough in there. So for me, I love cookies and cream. It is a great matchup. It really, really is. But like chocolate chip cookie dough, to me, is maybe my all-time favorite flavor of ice cream in general. And so this is what I'm going to go with. And you do have to be a cagey vet to know how to eat it and eat it the right way, which I definitely do.
So, wow. I'll give you that point. It's a psychological journey, right? So if you're eating cookies and cream, every bite is delicious and you know what you're going to get is consistent top to bottom. The cookie dough, you're going to enjoy every bite. Like when you hit like the one or two big rocks, right, in the cone or whatever, that's like a psychologically you're like, oh, this is La Vie, you know what I mean? I found it. It's a little bit more of a journey with the cookie dough. There's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I don't get it in a cone very often. You know what I mean? So I'm usually spooning it out of a bowl or out of a pint or out of the bucket, whatever it's in. And so I'll flip around. You know what I mean? Like I'll move the ice cream around and make sure that I can get as many bites with chunks of cookie dough in it as I possibly can.
Brandon, could I eat ice cream with you sometime? I'm going to enjoy this whole setting.
Absolutely. 100%, man. Yeah, no.
It'd be fun.
But I do think, though, I honestly, all that being said, Chris, I do think cookies and cream gets the win. But it doesn't mean I'm not pulling for cookie dough. 100%.
Yeah, I didn't know we were going to get consumption strategy as part of the analysis. That is really above and beyond the call, Noble. Well done. Well,
look, man, I do what I can to educate the good people of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
That is ultimate. Tell them to pick up a pen and a piece of paper before the damn thing starts. So
this conversation is way more interesting than Chris's hobby horse, which is Bill O'Brien and whether he's a good X's and O's coach. As soon as I saw that news today, I'm like, oh my gosh, Chris is going to be obsessed with this all day. Did he deserve this? What is the X's and O's football mindset? Is he a good coach? Is he a bad coach? I could give, like I said on the first podcast, two shits about what kind of X's and O's coach that guy is. I'll love him forever. Nothing to do with on the field, and I don't care. But this is Chris even he has a special guest coming on. Chris is so excited about talking about Bill O'Brien and the NFL. So we'll have Chad on here in a minute, but I certainly prefer ice cream consumption to Bill O'Brien, but I'm here for it. I'm here for it either way, Chris. I'm with you, brother.
I mean, as usual, you've grossly mischaracterized my position and behavior, but we'll talk about Bill a little bit later. I do find him a fascinating
with the special guest that you invited on specifically to talk about him.
Yeah, no, look, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. I find him to be a fascinating figure because most times when there is somebody, when it comes to Penn State football, who is of his stature, that person is or has been around here for a long time. Right. So the fact that he sort of like just drifted in and out of the Penn State football story and the Penn State story and yet was so impactful makes him distinct. He has got a distinct story and it's unique and it's interesting to me. But to put a button on the ice cream thing, you got me thinking, Kev, when you talked about the way they infuse the ice cream with the cookie flavor. That's a big plus. If I had to cast my vote, God, you know what? It would be really close, but I think I would probably go cookies and cream in the end because, like you said, two strong contenders, but man, the cookies and cream is truly flawless. And that is my prediction for what's going to win. So three of us have cookies and cream coming out. Kevin, you, even though you are a cookies and cream voter, you think the grandma's baked cookies nostalgia is going to put cookie dough over the top. So we'll see. Voting opens at 9 a.m. on Tuesday. The 6th runs through noon on Friday. That'll be the case this week and for the following 4 weeks in the Berkey Creamery's Flavor Fantasy Flavor League. I want to keep saying Flavor Madness. That was back in March. Fantasy Flavor League. And every week, one lucky voter wins a gift card to the Creamery. There are sales and promotions going along in conjunction with this, and the winner of the 6 bowl game matchups will be part of the Creamery's next flavor pack at the end of the quote-unquote season. And by then, we'll have some real Penn State football. So join in on the fun. Register yourself to win a Creamery gift card and log on to creamery.psu.edu/fantasy-flavor-league. to vote all this week and follow along on the Creamery's social channels. So, guys,
Chris, I have a question for you about Penn State.
Michael, please.
Penn State football,
please.
So, if they don't play any games and they keep going up in the bowl in the poll, they're down at 9 now, right? Maybe they shouldn't play until they're in the top 4. Then maybe I don't know how this works. Just like, how could they be where they are without playing a game? I don't understand that.
Well, it is a little preposterous every week when you see the journalists on Twitter posting. First, they post their AP ballot, and then they have to clarify whether or not they have chosen to rank the teams that aren't playing currently. So we have, first of all, here is my subjective view of the 25 best college football programs in America, even though there's like 130 of them. And then on top of that, here is my subjective, totally arbitrary decision as to whether or not I'm going to exclude, you know, like 35% of them for the next 4 weeks. So as useless as the polls typically are, they're at least doubly so this year. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't even paid anything beyond passing attention to what Penn State is ranked right now, because I think it is more meaningless than it ever was before, if that's possible.
Okay. All right.
You're too busy watching the Texans.
Yes. Yes. I do. I love Houston Texans football so much, indeed. Almost as much as I love recruiting, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
It's ironic that we'll probably talk to Chad about a recruit tonight. Two, actually, I just thought about that.
Oh, man.
But the Penn State Media Day was last week, and there were, you know, like everything else this year, it's crazy. It was all by Zoom. And they did a really good job, I thought, providing access to a lot of different players. And I had two takeaways from watching the coach interviews. So they talked to James Franklin and all three of his coordinators. And then many, many players were made available. It's all up on YouTube. Go PSU TV if you want to check it out. It's a good way to fill your time as you're getting ready for Penn State football to start. I had two takeaways. Number one, I love Joe Lohrig, the special teams coordinator. I love that
yes.
guy. Like his affect, just the way he comes across is great. When he got here last year, replacing Phil Galliano, who I don't think anyone would dispute did not light the world on fire as the special teams coordinator for Penn State, I liked him right out of the gate because he seemed very confident, and he talked about one of the things that he did with his approach to special teams was he broke out all the different roles on special teams basically into like position groups, and he had separate team meetings for these different position groups to really dial in on the details of what they have to do. And I thought, man, that's pretty creative approach. And if you go back and you look at the NCAA's special teams rankings, I have no idea how those are calculated, but the NCAA does publish a list, like there's wow. ranked offenses, defenses, and special teams units. Memphis, which is where he was before he came to Penn State, was consistently ranked in the top five during the last, especially the last few years he was there. Then he came to Penn State, and immediately Penn State took a huge jump from middle of the pack to top five, and Memphis backslid just a little bit, but was still a top 10 team with basically his scheme and his guys in place last season. So the numbers bear out that this guy really does seem to know what he's talking about. And then to listen to him again talk about his approach to the COVID-19 offseason and how he feels very strongly about getting some starting caliber players involved on all four of the special teams units. And he said he sort of judges how much some of your key leaders on the team really are bought in and how much they love football by whether or not they're pushing to play a role on special teams. And he said he's been seeing a lot of that during the offseason. Starters on both sides of the ball coming in and requesting to be part of the special teams units. I don't know. I feel like that is has potential to be a big difference maker for Penn State this year.
He strikes me as a guy, Chris, I think to stereotype, a lot of special teams coaches are just sort of put there because they're young and it's one of their first jobs and they don't have another spot for them. They work their way up and they start there. Joe's, I think, a little bit, I don't know really anything about his history other than the Memphis stop. He's a little bit of an older guy for, I think, the average special teams coordinator. And the way he talks about special teams is like more specific, I guess, and sophisticated than I think we've ever heard at Penn State, maybe ever.
Yeah, I mean, it's cerebral, I think, is a fair description.
Yeah. Like he was talking about, yeah, like they were asking about the Falcons onside kick thing. And then he went off on a tangent about like onside kick theories and how, you know, there's what they're going to work on and things like that. And yeah, I really enjoy, it was a quick interview, but I really enjoyed the video of that. And I think he's definitely legit, certainly more legit than we've had in a long time, probably ever, because the stereotype I just mentioned was certainly true during the Paterno era. And all of our special teams coordinators since then, when we have had them, have sucked. So this will be a nice change of pace. And we have one of the best kickers in college football, so that could be a good combination here.
You know, that's a position that I think, Kevin, I know nothing about the guy at all. I you guys know my disdain for kickers and that whole thing. But that being said, right, it is an important part of the game, and you have to have it. And what I found is in my time in football, right, there's two different kinds of special teams coordinators. There's a guy that's kind of like what Kevin mentioned, right? There's a guy that's either an up-and-comer who's just looking for a job and is trying to break in, and that's how he ends up there, right? He ends up being the special teams graduate assistant, then he just kind of graduates to it, and eventually he wants to go do something else. Then there's a group of guys, though, that realize that if you become a special teams coach and you get really good at it, you literally will have a job for the rest of your life because no one wants that job, right? Like that is the hardest coordinating job that there possibly could be. You are taking guys from all the different position groups of the team, both sides of the ball, bringing them together with the least amount of practice time and the least amount of meeting time, and then you're some of the biggest transfers of yardage happen on those plays.
Sure.
There is right. absolute yep. every is puckered when that ball goes in the air. If you're on the kick team, right? Especially if you know you're not good. So like that guy, right? The guys, and the funny thing is I hadn't thought about Penn State or college special teams in a long time. But like in the NFL, like I was a guy named Danny Smith, who's with the Steelers now. And he is a guy that is a special teams coach. Like
yes.
The guy that was in Dallas when I was there is a guy named Joe Avizzano, and Avi passed away years ago, right? But Joe was legendary, and his special teams, you didn't want to be on it, but like if he picked you to be on his special teams, it was something special. Even like my fourth year in Dallas, I had started for 3 years. He still put me as the wedge captain on kickoff return, right? Because he loved me and I wanted to do it for him, right? Like I felt the same way about the guy. It is definitely something that that it is. If you don't have somebody that really wants to be a special teams coordinator, you're not going to have a great special teams man. But if you find a guy that he lives and breathes it, and like Kev said, you know, goes into a dissertation about that terrible onside kick recovery that the Falcons had a couple weeks ago, you know, like that to me is a great sign that special teams hopefully will be impactful this year in a positive way. Now I've talked about ice cream and special teams tonight. I think I probably need to go to bed. But look, man, I think that's a good sign. But it's a thankless, miserable, not miserable is not the right word, but it is a hard job, man. I mean, you're pulling guys. You have no time at all to meet or practice or get together or anything. It's a tough, tough job. I got a lot of respect for those guys.
To my earlier point, it was interesting listening to him talk about the push and pull between deciding how many starters you use on your special teams units. Because, you know, that's extra snaps for those guys. It's exposing them to injury. But at the same time, you want to have your best, most impactful players in on those plays that you said, Brandon, can impact the game tremendously in terms of field position. One of the other interesting things he said is, it's cool to listen to a guy who has really thought this through, is he talked about how on offense or defense, if you have a bad down, if a play goes badly, you just come back on the next play and try to make it up. You give up a sack on first down, you've got second and long. You've got two shots to try to get it back, and then maybe you can extend your drive. But if you screw up a special teams play, first of all, everyone's going to know it happened, and there's no fixing it. That's it. You're done. And at Penn State, historically, that has been a sore spot for us because – Joe never had a dedicated special teams coordinator. He always, because now they've loosened up the coaching limitations a little bit since the end of Joe's career. The NCAA has allowed you to do a little bit more with the size of your staff. But because of that, because there was a hard cap on the number of assistants you could have, Joe never wanted to commit to having one guy in charge of the special teams. So he would divide the responsibilities among the other assistants. And many fans complained for many years, myself among them, that seemed to hold back the performance of the special teams units, which do impact the games a lot. And again, man, before Blake Gillikin got to Penn State, the punting situation was so bad. I think it probably lost Penn State. I think it lost Penn State two games over the first two years of James Franklin's tenure. I would say probably more, but to be conservative, punting probably lost us two games because of field position.
Yeah, Alex Buttersworth, I remember him. His last name's now racist. To bleep that out. But my favorite one of us on the special teams track, my favorite, they had, this is like the only time you get to talk to like some of the special teams guys all year is during media day. So they marched out Chris Stoll, the long snapper, to talk to the media.
Yep. And good for him.
He seems like a great guy. He's started every game last year at long snapper, coming back this year. there was like maybe three reporters that hopped in to talk to him at any given point. And I was so my favorite media day story. And again, I focus on the media because I still have that mindset. The new Center Daily Times football reporter, I think his name's Parth. Seems like a really nice guy, but classic Center Daily Times football reporter who will be here for like 4 months and then go do something else when the Center Daily Times like won't. He's just on food stamps working for the CDT because they're terrible and they don't pay any money and no one subscribes. No offense to him. I'm sure he's very talented. Came from UNC. I looked him up because I was so amused by him because every single player they put out, which was literally like 25 players, he would just bounce from room to room and he would hop in. He'd be like, hey, Chris Stoll, who's Journey Brown, you know, I know you're on different sides of the ball, but, you know, what do you have to say about all the adversity he's overcome to like play so well last year? And all these, none of these, like Chris Stoll has probably never spoken to Journey Brown in his life. And Chris is like, oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a really good player. And he's like, and I just want to follow up on that. Like, when you say good player, you know, that 200 yards in the Cotton Bowl, like, what do you think led him to really go off there at the end of last year? And Chris is like, yeah, Journey works hard. Yeah, man, good player, gonna be good. And every single player, no matter what position they played, this dude would hop in and be like, "Tell me about Journey Brown." And I've been on the edge of my seat every day since media day, waiting for this dude's Journey Brown story to hit. it is not out yet, but that thing better win a Pulitzer Prize because there was at least 100 Journey Brown questions asked in total on that day. So I'm excited for that. But I watched the Chris Stoll press conference. He's so excited. You know, some guy, the local newspaper, hops into his room, going to ask the long separate questions, and then he just asks him about Journey Brown. It's pretty comical. But I like Chris Stoll. We have a if there is such a thing as a veteran special teams unit, Penn State has it with returning kickers and long snappers and things. There's something to be said for that. And a holder, I think, does Pinniger hold? I think our holder's back. And Drew Hartlob is in contention for being the fastest player on the team. Like he runs like a 4.2 apparently, and he's basically special teams only. So, yeah, a lot of veterans on the special team side of the ball. Something to be said for that.
Yeah, I mean, especially in a season like that, you do not want to have those kind of plays go south on you. So having some experience there and some consistency, I think, is going to be good. So it's funny you mentioned the thing about – go ahead.
And we know what they all think about Journey Brown now, thanks to the CDT, which is so funny.
you mentioned that to me, and I was earlier this evening, I was listening to Mike Mennett's interview, which I enjoyed quite a lot. He was a lot of fun to listen to. They let him go for about a half hour, too. These were long interviews. It was great, too. It was I think the Zoom format with the players was really cool because they did let the reporters really get in and ask multiple follow-up questions, and it was fun to listen to them interact with the players like this. In some ways, I think, with all due respect to Mike the Mailman not getting to go walk around Beaver Stadium this year, I think it was a superior format for everyone but you, Mike. It was good, and I did chuckle to myself when I heard the CDT reporter come in on Mennett's interview. I was like, this has got to be a Journey Brown question. And sure enough, it was.
It was.
But talking
– And then he would go, Chris, he'd be like, so all the adversity overcame, you know, tell me about that. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, adversity. Yep, he overcame adversity. He was real good. And then it like there'd be a third follow-up. He goes, so by adversity, do you mean the death of his grandmother? And they're like, yeah, that's what I meant. Yep. Like he would, I know exactly what the story is going to say. It's like Journey Brown is good because the death of his grandmother motivates him, which I'm sure is like part of it, but also is probably mostly because he's just really good and is strong and works hard. But yeah, just hilarious stuff. I do agree the format was better than the typical format, which is like gaggle, right? They just march all the players out on the field and then everyone just sort of surrounds them and talks to them. A few reasons. One was we actually got everything recorded because it's just easy to record a Zoom meeting. Two, everyone got to ask questions they wanted to, right? So you weren't sort of, you know, if it was normal times, like Sean Clifford would have like Dave Jones up in his grill and Mark Brennan on the other side and Bob, whatever. The main guys just sort of surrounding him and they'd get to ask all the questions. And if you were sort of all the way in the back, you might be a little bit too timid to get in there or you know, it's actually sort of a physical game at that point.
Well, and everyone's trying to get, everybody's got cameras, so everybody's trying to get a good angle. And so, like,
yeah, the broadcast people clog it all up.
Yeah, all these fat, sweaty cameramen trying to push their way through. It's a good thing Mike's skinny. That helped them out on media day for sure.
So I really enjoyed the new format because everyone got to ask questions. We got recordings of all of them. It was like a little bit more. I mean, they were all sitting in their rooms, right? They weren't just out in the sun, just sort of waiting for people to come by. I really liked it. It sort of shows how useless it actually is for the media to be there in person most of the time. Like,
sorry, Mike.
Like, there's really no need to like fly these guys all over the country when you can just zoom in and do the press conference. You know what I mean? Like, all the Penn State football beat's going to talk this year to James Franklin and whatever players they trot out, like, who are in Lincoln, Nebraska, while these guys are sitting at their houses in Port Matilda and Altoona and Harrisburg, whatever. And it's going to be the same content and the same quality of answers, if not even better, because it's a little bit more controlled. So that's my media geeking out, my media sense geeking out there. But man, I cannot freaking wait. I literally have tweet notifications turned on for this guy because I just want to read this Journey Brown story as soon as it pops. So we're just waiting.
Good stuff. So just to rewind a little bit, I was talking about Mike Bennett. The other thing that I took away from watching these interviews, coaches and players, I think we can be at least cautiously optimistic about Penn State's offensive line this year, and specifically what bringing Phil Troutwine in is going to mean for the production on the field. Now, as we've discussed before, and we talked about it last week, I can be a pretty unforgiving critic of the assistant coaching situation at Penn State. And I think that, you know, again, I think that is one of the major differentiators between great and elite programs, is ones that are willing to go out and break the bank to get the very best coordinators at their respective jobs. And I feel great about bringing Joe Lorigan, like I just said. And I feel great about the Kirk Shiraka hire. And again, it seems to me, from everything I can glean from the guy's background, his track record at BC, and just judging from words and body language from the players on the offensive line, I think we maybe hit another home run with Troutwine, especially when it comes to player development and results on the field. And he lucks out that of the three offensive line coaches we've had here under James Franklin, he is inheriting by far the best situation, because I think Penn State's now got a two deep full of high-level recruits who have had a couple years in the program. But I remember when Herb Hand left and Matt Limegrover came in. And I'm not knocking Limegrover. I think he did a lot of good things, and I think he effected an upgrade over Herb Hand. But again, it's not about being pretty good. It's about being among the best in the country. And I'm not sure if he was the guy to get Penn State there. I mean, results-wise, you wanted to see a little bit faster progress than we had the last few years. But when Limegrover came in over Herb Hand, you know, the players say these coded things. It's like, oh, what's it like working with the new coach? And they're trying to find a nice way to say, well, this guy actually knows what he's doing, right? And you can hear them trying to work out in their head, like, how can I don't want to throw shade at my previous coach. I want to be diplomatic, but how can I say, man, this guy, like, he clearly knows what's up. Well, I think the same thing happened with Troutwine over Limegrover. Just go pick a couple of random offensive linemen out of the group they interviewed and listen to them talk about their coach. And they consistently go to a few things. They talk about technique. They talk about his background as a national champion in college and an NFL player and what that brings to the table. And they talk about the attitude, the nastiness that he demands of his players. And look, I think that's, you know, that's what that's, you know, that's 33% of it right there, is just being nasty and willing to punch a guy across the line of scrimmage from you. I mean, Goon says that all the time. Like, no matter what they were like off the field, that 94 offensive line, they were mean bastards.
They were
out on the field.
They were complete and total dicks.
Yeah, which is what you need. I mean, you need your O-line. They can be gentle giants off the field, but they need to be.
They were dicks off the field too.
Well, yeah, there you go. Yeah, I don't know. People always say Harding's is nice. I don't know. The rest of them, I've heard some stories.
He's nice now,
but you've got to be. You've definitely got to be a total on the field.
Yep.
And you know, look, if you have a guy that can teach attitude, that can teach technique, and brings a pedigree to the room that is going to make the kids pay attention when he talks, that's, you know, that's a pretty good hat trick. And so I'm excited about what I think looks to be another great James Franklin hire, another acknowledgement that we needed to upgrade, and then a hire that makes that happen.
Yeah.
They got to get the boys ready to block for Journey Brown, which we heard all about last week. No, Phil's good. It's interesting. We now have like a. I mean, you don't have to have been a good player to be a good coach, and in fact, it's often the opposite. Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, James Franklin played at East Stroudsburg, right? So, it, you know, that take that for what it's worth. But the fact that Phil Troutwine, a national champion, played in the league, you know, blocked for Tim Tebow, is on the staff, and we've talked about the wide receivers coach whose name is escaping me because I've been talking about Journey Brown, Taylor Stubblefield.
Yep.
There's a lot of good former players on this staff, and a lot of young ones too. So there's something to be said for that. So a lot different than when you played, Brandon.
Yes, definitely a lot different than when I played. That's an understatement for lack of a better term, even though it's the best term. Because the good thing when you've got guys that have played, especially guys that have played at a high level and played well at a high level, I think I mentioned this the other day, the credibility when that guy walks in the room is immediate, and you are willing to listen to them faster and buy into what they say faster than you would anybody else, right? If somebody comes into the room and has never put their hand in the dirt and had to take on a double team on third and short, and they're telling me a certain way to do it, and it's not the way that I've done it that's been successful, I'm going to have a real tough time believing them. But if someone who has played and done it at a high level, like I said, all those things, walks in the room and says, hey, this is how it works, right? This is how I'm going to want you to do it. I'll give it a try. A lot faster, right? And look, at the end of the day, just like a football team takes kind of its personality from the head coach, the position groups too, right? I mean, that's very, very true. And from the coordinators too. Each of those guys gets a little bit of say in what the group is like.
What did you take from your coordinator in college, Brandon?
You really want to ask that question?
tell them
please,
here.
Please don't bleep this out, Chris.
No. We'll leave that one where it was.
But you're right. Like Mike, I mean, Mike, you would not want someone delivering letters like to like rural America with unmarked houses and multi-unit buildings. You don't send the boys out there to those hard stretches without any letter carrying experience. Same sort of deal.
Your postal knowledge is right up there, Kevin. I love it. Thank you.
Well,
I've really ruined this podcast. I'm sorry.
No, that was good. That was good.
That was great. That was good. That was very good.
Not at all. Not in the slightest.
That was a good question.
That was a great question.
I obviously didn't learn anything. I don't want to throw those guys under the bus at all.
No.
Like, I've told you guys before, like I was so, and guys that played at my era will tell you too, like we were so ill prepared when we went into the NFL, for real football. It was amazing. It was shocking. I mean, it really was. The fact that those guys got out of us what they did and we won as many football games after I went back and learned football, like really learned football, is shocking. And look, and so you want to talk about Jerry, we'll talk about Jerry. So Jerry came and clinicked us at Westchester one time, right? And EJ, his son, was on the staff, right? And we're sitting there in the room, and I'm sitting there, right? It's my first time interacting at this level, right, with Jerry as a coach. And we're sitting there, and he's drawing on the board and this, that, and the other, right? And he draws.
Do I need to call the Attorney General before you say this, or are you going to be all right?
Okay. he draws two or three defenses up on the board and defends the play with 10 guys.
How did we win so many games? It boggles the mind.
I like Jerry's mindset there. If you can defend the play with 10, if you get 11, yeah, you saw what happened to Vinny Testaverde, folks. That was designed on 10 men defense.
I mean, I guess if you'd have put 13 up there, it would have been worse, right? But
you're right.
But yeah, I mean, I remember sitting in shock, like. When he left, everybody in the room was like, holy shit. Like, he drew half of those defenses with 10 guys up there. And you were like, that was amazing. But yeah, but it does. Look, man, the credibility, to bring this back full circle, the credibility of the coach is important. And it's more and more important the further into kind of the way the football is going right now, anyways, right? When it comes to recruiting. When it comes, because all these kids want to go play in the NFL, right? And Joe, again, I love Joe Sarah. You didn't go to Penn State to play for Joe Sarah, right? You went to Penn State to play for Joe Paterno. Joe Sarah wasn't going to get you into the NFL, right? But he was going to make you tough, and he was going to make you a great college football player. But if you go and play for somebody who's played in the NFL, they can go into a living room and say, hey, look, I know how to get to the NFL. I've been there. I know how to be an All-American in college. I've been there. Come play for me, and I'll do that for you.
Yep.
I think that's why Ohio State's had such success in their wide receivers coach is some one of the guys, right? I mean, he's like a – I'm trying to think of what the guy's name is.
But Brian Hartline.
Right. He had a really good career, right, and at Ohio State, I believe,
mm-hmm.
right?
And then, yes.
And he's transitioned that into being able to recruit kids and bring them in and coach them and turn them into great – you know, not only great college football players, but great NFL players too. And that's a part of the battle. You know, it really is. So I have stayed longer than I said I was going to stay tonight. Kevin got me into a corner talking about Sandusky. And on that note, I am going to call it an evening and let you guys talk about whatever the hell it is comes up next.
This is a full podcast.
I think
ice cream special teams and your former coordinator.
Right. We can call him Jerry Sandusky. I have no problem saying his name. So.
I'm just being polite. That's part of the bit, Brandon. Part of the bit.
I know.
Because I want people to look it up. Be like, oh, that's why he's being funny.
All right.
Oh, well. Now we know he likes 10 more than 11. So we got straightened out.
I'm going to sneak out of here and let you guys talk about Bill O'Brien for a little while.
All right, so we'll take a quick break here, and we'll just talk a little Bill O'Brien. Not too much, Kev, I promise. On the other side, stick with us. Our friends at the Happy Valley Adventure Bureau know you want to be a part of the Penn State experience by visiting Happy Valley. They just ask that you mask up and practice social distancing during your visit. For all the attractions, specials, and travel packages to help plan your trip, go to happyvalley.com. Okay, and we're back. Chris Bucanani here on the Obligatory PSU podcast with Kevin Horn and Mike the Mailman. As you heard, we booted Brandon Noble out. He went to bed. But joining us now from down in Houston, Texas, for the Fort Bend Herald, journalist Chad Washington, Penn State alum, longtime Houston football fan. And, well, Chad, we had you on earlier in the summer to talk about the status of Bill O'Brien's job with the Texans, and now we know. Not so good.
Yeah, it's expected, but not expected this early. I didn't expect this to happen this quickly. I mean, 0-4, you know, it's not good, but it's not like a death sentence. You know, some teams, the small number of teams, still make the playoffs. But for, you know, the Texans to just cut him off like right now and just say, that's it, get out of here. It's kind of shocking, especially considering the Texans played such a tough schedule. And, you know, the Chiefs to start off, then the Ravens and the Steelers. And yeah, they played the Vikings that are 0-3, but the Vikings have some good talent. And, you know, those last two games were close, but enough people just said, that's it. You got to get out of here. We got to go in a new direction. And Bill O'Brien's now looking for a job now.
Yeah, Chad, you know, it's funny. I was actually just the other day like listening back through to the show we had you on back, I think it was end of July, beginning of August, and you said one of the things that you felt maybe helped secure O'Brien's job status was the relationship he had with the owner, who is, I can't forget, he's Bob McNair's son. I can't remember his name.
Cal McNair is the son of Bob McNair, who passed away.
So that obviously turned pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was going to be a done deal, that if it's like, okay, they're 0-8, then maybe we could do something. But I think a lot of this is just, I think a lot of this is that Bill O'Brien really just started losing the room. You know, from what I hear from other reports, from other, you know, what's going on there, is that Bill O'Brien, you know, he's a fiery kind of guy. He likes to do things his way, you know, and he just started to kind of lose the room, lose the players. The locker room kind of just turned against him a little bit after the loss to the Ravens. I think a lot of that, too, was he was trying to bring Earl Thomas in, and the locker room was like, no, don't bring him in here. He's a locker room killer. What are you doing? And ever since then, it's just the players kind of just, I won't say they revolted, but they really started turning on Bill O'Brien and just said that, and the owner kind of realized that and saw that and just said, okay, well, we got to make a move. I mean, and one little thing I'll make a quick point on. I watched on Big Ten Network the 2013 game against Nebraska. You know, and I look at the play calling that Bill O'Brien was doing, and I'm like, this is a repeat of the Oilers almost. I mean, the Texans, I'm sorry, say Oilers. This is kind of repeat what's going on here in Houston. The same kind of play calling. And I think, and I'll just reiterate what I said in the earlier when I was with you guys, that, you know, it's one thing when you're not playing for a Big Ten championship, you can just call whatever plays. Yeah, it was fourth and four. Yeah, let's just go for it. We're deep in our territory. Yeah, let's just go for it. Let's do it. And it's a little bit different to do that in the NFL when every game counts, especially when you try to get either a playoff position or you're trying to, you know, get some momentum towards next week. And if you're on the road and get Kansas City, you say, you know, it's fourth and one. Let's call a fake punt. If it doesn't work, it's lethal, you know, in the NFL. And when you're, you know, you're against Nebraska in the snow, it's like, well, fourth down, well, we're not playing for anything. Let's do it and see what happens. And I just think a lot of that kind of just, I think the sanctions kind of just covered up a lot of things that we figured out about Bill O'Brien, the play caller. And it just kind of metastasized itself in the NFL. You look at what he did with the Texans, it just, some of the things are just kind of, you know, like, really, why are we doing this? Why would you call it that play at that time? And, you know, fortunately, fans got tired of it, and then the players got tired of it, and now he's out. That's an unfortunate thing. But, you know, let me just say, Bill O'Brien is a good guy. And as a Penn State alum, I really do appreciate for what he did to Penn State. It's just, it's a shame it didn't work out here in Houston.
Yeah, you know, you just said something really interesting. I always wondered, watching Bill during those 2 years as a play caller, is this guy doing this just because there's nothing at stake here? Like, there's no bowl game on the line. There's no conference title. So if we lose, you know, whatever. We lost this game this week, and it's truly on to the next. So why not go for it on fourth down? But at the time, I'm thinking this guy is going to be our coach for a while, and eventually the sanctions are going to be over. And I'm like, is he still going to be calling games like this when you can't lose one game or you're out of the national title race? So it is interesting to see that was – just the dude's personality, and it fit the situation at Penn State perfectly.
Yeah, he fit what Penn State needed at the time, too. I mean, think about it from those days with Joe Pa, where, you know, we had, it was like an act of God just to do the shotgun formation. It was like, oh my goodness, shotgun. And for Bill to just try to do an up-tempo, kind of quick kind of play calling, saying, you know, fourth down, oh, well, let's go for it. Why are we screwing around? And no, that was a godsend for Penn State to do it at the time. So I totally get that was, I thought it was his personality too, and I thought that would be refreshing in the NFL. But the problem is, you got to call the right play if you're going to go for it on fourth down.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be like, okay, let's throw it's fourth and seven, let's throw a 5-yard in pattern to the receiver and then he'll get free and run. But what if they're jamming them and covering them tight and he can't get away? Well, then it's fourth, then we're 2 yards short. So that kind of stuff just doesn't work. It just depends on what kind of play call you have. And, you know, it also helps when you have good superstars like DeAndre Hopkins that can make incredible plays when you go for it on fourth down or you take a shot downfield. And when you trade them away,
unless you become the general manager and trade them away. Right.
Is that part of it too? Right. Like, I don't know how many coaches in the NFL are both the coach and the general manager, but as someone who only follows Penn Staters, which also crosses over with Philadelphia, the only two that I know of are Bill O'Brien and Chip Kelly. I'm sure there are many more. That seems like from the moment that DeAndre Hopkins got traded, that it was just sort of over at that point, despite the fact he's the only winning coach in Texans history. They seem to make the playoffs every year. Is that extra responsibility partially to blame? Does that ever work out to you two NFL fans? Because I have no idea. It doesn't seem like it does.
It rarely does. You have to be, I mean, let's put it this way. Like you, every head coach has to have a good relationship with their general manager. So you can't, you know, you can't be fighting over players or fighting over contracts or stuff like that. You have to be on the same page. And how Bill O'Brien got it, he just kind of just fell into it because the Texans had a general manager that, you know, when he came in, they had a general manager, Rick Smith. They got, you know, they had a falling out and Rick had to go. Then they tried to hire this Brian Gain guy who was underneath O'Brien, and he knew him. And then all of a sudden he's fired for reasons we don't know. I mean, it's just like quick and he was fired. And it's like, what happened? And ever since then, Bill O'Brien was like, well, you know what? There's no GM. I'll just do all the roles. I'll take care of all of this and I'll do it. And it kind of created a mess there because then, you know, some of our players are gone. Jadeveon Clowney's been traded. It's like, okay, and we got two bench warmers for him. And it was like, okay, that's not a good trade. And then right when they got to DeAndre, I mean, I understand what the thing was. DeAndre wanted a big bank and he wanted a big contract. Okay. He's not going to get one in Houston. We're going to give it to Deshaun Watson. Okay. So you're going to trade him, right? Yeah. Well, what are we going to get from the return? Well, now we'll get a running back on his last legs and a third round and a second round pick. A second round pick? He's the best receiver in the league. Get a first round pick. And we just couldn't get it. And then what's also hurting this franchise, we traded away this coming season. Our 2021 first round pick and second round pick are now property in Miami because we had to do that to get a left tackle to help protect Deshaun's blind side. So it's even if the Texans tank, they will not have a chance to rebuild. And we have all this money stuck in with Deshaun and stuck in with Laremy Tunsil. Even if you fire Bill O'Brien, and we're still in this hole, and we can't even get out of it. We can't even get out of it in a year. It's going to take about 2 years to get out of this hole. So that's the other reason why you're like, okay, why are we firing Bill O'Brien now when we're already in the hole? You might as well hold on to him and see if he can dig out of it.
But yes. And again, if someone doesn't know anything about the structure, really, it seems a little bit like the joint head coach GM thing's a little bit of a conflict of interest that could breed hostility, right? Because, you know, if you're negotiating your new contract, like you just talked about, that this reminded me because you talked to me about how Hopkins wanted a big contract. If you're renegotiating your contract with the GM, you know, you and your coach are kind of on the same page. Like if you're a good player, the coach wants to keep you. They're like, yeah, come on, like you're great. I want to play. I want you to be here. But if your coach is also responsible for like getting you at the lowest price possible, like that seems like a conflict, especially if that coach also decides how many touches you get, how often you get the ball, how often you see the field. That just seems like it could be a mess because just in a general workplace environment, we probably all know this, like if you're, you know, anyone who's not cutting the check is sort of on the same page, right? And once you start dealing with the person cutting the check who has to work to get to pay you the least amount of money possible for you to still work there, that starts, I don't know. It's sort of like the suits are all on the field. And that I don't think that just as in a general sense, in a corporate structure type thing, that doesn't seem like it would work too well. And we see that over and over again, I guess. And Bill O'Brien here is the latest victim. And they also lost to the Vikings. There's also that, but you know.
it's also kind of just a locker room thing. If you know, you have a stud player in DeAndre Hopkins who's balled out and done everything that you wanted to, you know, a star receiver could do for a franchise and help you get, like, you know, the playoffs for the last 6 years. And then you're just going to say, well, your contract's time is up and we can't pay you, so we're just going to trade you. That, how's the locker room feel? Why would anybody want to stick around to a team if they're going to say, well, you know, yeah, we think you're good, we just can't afford you anymore, so we're going to dump you somewhere or trade you away somewhere. And it was just, it's deflating to the locker room. It's deflating for the fans to have your best players just walk and, you know, go away and you don't get another stud player in return. Like, for, like I said before, the Texans couldn't even get like a first or second round pick either this past draft or the upcoming draft this year. So it's like, what can we do? And that's the problem when you have a coach and a GM doing, you know, doing this kind of things. You have to split them up. You take care of the play calling, Bill. You're the offensive guru. You take care of the play calling. We'll worry about the contract later. We'll worry about the you know, getting the kind of other players later, or have somebody else do that. That's the whole idea. And that just, you know, you do too much work and things start to lack, you know, get bad. And I think, you know, him being the GM helped messed up what consistency he had on offense. And we just really, I mean, the offense couldn't run, couldn't do anything. And we're now 0-4. And now, you know, that's it. And it's time for a change. And fans are kind of frustrated. There were sacks in the stands. I think one dude brought us, you know, the bag over his head. Now,
Doing
that, then things are kind of getting bad in Houston because we don't do that.
Like
that's
the Aints.
Orleans thing.
The Aints of the late 80s and early 90s. Oh, no.
Bags.
Yeah, I don't know. Come on, guys. So, yeah, the coach GM thing is too much. It's too much for one guy to do. Don't tell me Bill Belichick can do it because he's the exception that proves a rule again and again. A couple of quick questions for you, Chad, and thanks for jumping on short notice and joining us and doing this.
No problem.
I'm assuming the general reaction from the fan base down there is positive to this move.
Oh, you kidding me? Astros won a playoff game and Bill O'Brien's out of here. People are partying in the streets out here.
I'm trying to be diplomatic, but yeah, for poor Bill. Yeah, that's sort of what I assumed. Do you have any notion, and I know I'm totally putting you on the spot here, any idea at all where you think his path might lead him next? Because I look at him and he seems like naturally an NFL guy. I think he's most comfortable as a play caller. He had most success in college, did not seem to love all the glad handing and recruiting you had to do there. I don't know if he's the type of guy who could jump right into another head coaching job. Could he be a coordinator somewhere? Could he possibly go back to college? Where do you think he goes from here?
You know, I was thinking this and not hearing about the reports of who the Texans are thinking about getting there. I mean, the Jack Easterby, who was like the assistant GM, he's now the new interim GM. They have a line with the New England Patriots, and one of the people they are saying is best friends with him is like Josh McDaniels, who's the offense coordinator there. And if you get in the Houston, that would be something. And you can think about New England saying, well, who do we replace? Well, let's go get Bill. You know, Bill was from here. He knows the system. He knows Belichick. Let's bring him in there. So I think that would be a perfect fit to do like a trade. That's why I wish we could have done Josh McDaniel come here to Houston, be the head coach, and send Bill back to New England where he could be with Belichick and he can, you know, help out with Cam Newton and try to do some things there, because again, you have a system there. They have a system. He fits in that system perfectly.
I love that. That would be interesting. Well, let me tell you,
answer it.
Go ahead, Kev.
He'll be a special assistant in Alabama before the week's over. That's what's next. That's where they all go out to pasture.
I was thinking about that.
I don't know, Bill, if I want him to. Him and Saban would have a fight. I would just think those two guys are just so bullheaded against each other. I don't know if they would coexist with that. So we'll see.
Bill O'Brien and Bo Pelini just leading the team out of the tunnel. I'm signing up for that.
See, Bill's safe, though, from the Alabama, you know, Nick Saban's internship program for wayward former head coaches, because he has no scandal. He was just bad. He just got fired. I like the idea of him going back to New England. I hate Josh McDaniels, because had he not played footsie with the Colts and left their job at the last minute, the Colts never would have poached Frank Reich from Philadelphia. So, you know, Josh could do me maybe a minor karmic solid here by letting Bill find a soft landing spot by taking that Houston job.
Yeah.
But I like that.
I'm Yeah, the Texans kind of want to be like New England. We're like New England. They're like New England South over there. They want to do everything like the Patriots. So I'm thinking that's him, although my personal pick is Eric Bieniemy to replace him. He's done a great job in Kansas City, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, that would be a great hire. I agree. I love me my Andy Reid coaching tree, guys. Okay, Chad, last question. I'm going to totally shift gears on you. I'm going to go back to Penn State football.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you about this when we had you on. Last time we just didn't have enough time, but I am going to make sure we do it this time because I think it's more relevant than ever. There is a recruit who is being talked about a lot. Not a recruit, now a player. He was a recruit that you covered when he played high school down there, high school ball down there in Fort Bend. Parker Washington, freshman wide receiver, being talked about a lot as an impact guy who will come out and get on the field for Penn State right out of the gate. I'm just wondering, what kind of insight can you give us into what sort of player James Franklin got in this kid?
Man, Parker was ready. By the way, no relation to Parker Washington, but man, he was ready to go as senior year of high school. He's built. He's quick. He makes incredible catches. He runs great routes. He's not a speed guy. You know, he's not going to leave everybody in the dust, but he's quick enough to beat his man and get open and make some catches, and he'll make some plays. So I'm not surprised that hearing the early reports that he might hit the field for Penn State. He makes great catches. He's like, I would say, a Danny Amendola kind of guy that just, if you need a first down, you need a big catch. He could make that catch. And I don't want to put any pressure on him like that, but I have to see that kind of mold of him in Penn State's offense. I want to see how he, I'm waiting for the depth chart to come out. I'm one of the eager guys. I really want to see where he is on that depth chart, because I know you still got some players ahead of him that are really good, and I want to see how they do, like Daniel George. I want to see where he is. I know Jahan Dotson's going to be the A1 guy, but I really want to see where Parker gets in the mix and if he can get on the field, because I think he can be a really good player for Penn State. I won't say special, but I think he'll be really good and, help out with that offense. I just want to see that, and also how the new offense coordinator kind of works with everything, because I really am excited for this offense. I think Parker can contribute to a lot of things, but as you know, Penn State has a lot of weapons, but we'll see how things look when they take the field against Indiana in a couple weeks.
Yeah, well, you just said lines up with what I've read about him, which is polished, college-ready, really good route runner for a freshman coming in, and a good hands guy. So look, I mean, Kirk Ciaraca made a lot of hay in Minnesota last year with a great group of wide receivers and having a dependable possession guy. Now, I don't want to say possession almost feels like it's a knock on receivers now, but having a guy who you just know that he's going to be where he's supposed to be on his route, and he's going to make the catch if you get the ball within his catch radius, that's big-time stuff. So that's cool, man. I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping we get to see a little bit of him this year. Parker Washington out of Fort Bend, Texas.
I definitely will, too, because I think the other thing, too, he makes Odell Beckham kind of catches as well. He made a couple of touchdowns where he's just, like, falling back, got one hand on the ball, and still catches it. So, I mean, I would love to see him do that at Penn State, but, we'll have to see if he gets on the field to get the opportunity to do all that.
I mean, even if he can just provide some quality depth this year in an unsettled wide receiver room, that'll be big. Plus, we want to get those Texas guys, man. We want to get that pipeline going. More Texas to Happy Valley. I like that.
Coach Franklin, you need a Texas guy. Holler at your boy. That's all I got to say. We got enough talent. Hey, everybody's coming down here. I mean, Ohio State and Michigan's not Nebraska had a pipeline for Texas players down here. So the Big Ten definitely has a footprint here. I know it's SEC country mostly in Big 12, but there's some Big Ten coaches coming in here. So, Penn State wants to join the party. I'll definitely like to help out with that.
Hook them up. Well, and now that UT stinks, might as well come here.
Come on. This is every year. And that's the sad thing about it, is that Texas and Texas A&M dominate so much of recruiting, and yet they both – you just know they're going to disappoint. You know Texas is going to lose a game they have no business losing, and A&M is just going to get stomped by Bama, Auburn, or LSU, or all three. So it's like, you know, that's why I'm just like, okay, when does Penn State come on, or when the native season gets started? Because I really have no Texas team. I mean, I have Houston. Houston can't even get on the field because of COVID. So other than that, I'm just waiting for Penn State football to start.
You and me both, man.
Seriously.
Good stuff, Chad. Thanks for joining us, man. Best of luck to Bill O'Brien, wherever he goes next. I hope it's not in college. So I want to thank Chad Washington from the Fort Bend Herald for joining us, and for Mike the Mailman, Kevin Horn, Brandon Noble, and myself, Chris Buchanani. We're signing off here on the Obligatory PSU Podcast. All that good stuff about five-star ratings and reviews that I say at the end of every show. Let's just pretend that I said it and move on. Creamery.psu.edu. Whether you're a cookies and cream guy or you are all about the chocolate chip cookie dough.
Chad, which way are you going?
Yeah. Real quick. Cookies and cream, creamery ice cream now. Cookies and cream, chocolate chip cookie dough. Who you got?
Oh, man, I want the cookie dough, and I want the WPSX coffee break with it as well.
Okay, so but you're going cookie dough.
I'm cookie dough. Yeah, I'm cookie dough.
This one was divisive. It was divisive. So you make your voice heard whether you're a cookie dough or cookies and cream guy or gal. Creamery.psu.edu is where to vote. We'll be back real soon. So long, everyone.
That was the Obligatory PSU Podcast, presented by HappyValley.com. Like and follow at Obligatory PSU.
Every time you hit like and subscribe, Mike the Mailman smiles.